This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Today is my birthday!
Yes, it is.
We're gonna have fun on the CU podcast! Happy birthday to you, Pat!
Yes, it's a new CU podcast for Tuesday, May 9th. It's birthday. Wow, it's the first time I failed my birthday, I think.
Happy birthday, young man.
Thank you. Alongside Ian Ferguson, I'm the birthday boy.
Oh, you're the birthday boy. Yes, you are.
I'm the birthday boy. I'm young. We're talking about on the show today the new 2DS XL, which is new. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe thoughts, DLC for Breath of the Wild, Maker Studios being maybe done, Wolfenstein 3D 25th Anniversary, Elvis Collectibles, as well as a couple other things going on. And actually, there's no Q&A right now. Maybe we'll change that. Ian, what's going on in your world?
Just stuff.
just stuff?
Just stuff. Just working.
Very specific.
And things. Yeah, I mean, it's unexciting these days.
Come on, you're on the podcast. It has to be exciting.
Well, I mean, other than the fact that I am a member of the CU podcast and I receive the royal treatment wherever I go, which is exciting.
Well, you know, you get the people that say, well, I deserve a discount. Listen to the podcast. That's definitely a free benefit, right? Right?
Wait, how does that work? Hold on a second.
They get a discount?
They get a discount.
You know, when I see famous actors at Comic-Con, I go, hey, you know, you should just give me a free drink because I watched your movie.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it works.
No, the pain's been rough lately, so I've been binge-watching Forensic Files and Wee Bear Bears and some other cartoons.
Why
and stuff,
is Forensic right? Files so calming?
I don't.
When it's just death?
Because we're horrible people.
Okay, not all of it's death. 90% of the time, it's death.
Yeah, Bonnie gets like, kind of upset when it ends up being one that's like, oh, that was just a robbery.
they just saved the kid's life?
Yeah.
They overturned a conviction? Damn it.
This one's just about food poisoning.
Well, that's what the local one was about. The local one was about someone that died, but it overturned the conviction.
Mm-hmm.
You see that one?
Yes, I have.
That was a very special episode of Forensic Files. I was trying to get Frank to watch that one.
There's a special one that takes place in Buffalo about the Paladinos. That was a good one.
Yeah. No idea what that is. You just brought this to a halt. The Paladinos? What was that?
It was a murder case where he was slowly poisoning his wife to death.
Usually it's the opposite. Usually it's always women's tool of choice in murder is poison, slow poison, when you watch these shows. It's interesting.
Yeah, it was a bit of a reversal,
from
the Forensic Files norm.
I think they had one of the most famous ones, somewhat close to where I grew up. In New Jersey, there was a guy that killed his family and went on the run for, like, I think, like 10, 15 years before they found him.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But it was, like, an affluent part of New Jersey. He killed his whole family, got up and left. I think they tracked him down for, like, 10, 15 years or something. But, hey, but fun times. Birthday, you know, Carvel ice cream cake, you know, CU podcast.
Murder.
A certain NES Guide app is out. It's getting up, pumping to 1.3 version will be out there soon.
Nice.
Up to the point where, you know, I want it to be at for people to enjoy it and actually actively promote it. That'd be nice. Ian, you haven't tried the app, have you?
No.
Of course not. Other than that, there's an NES Punk episode in the works. Flea Market Madness just came out a couple weeks ago, which is just really tracking the death of the flea market as we know it, especially since we're a couple years behind me editing them. It's just, you can slowly see
how far behind are you?
2 years in editing them. Just about 2 years. I think the last one came out was like from early 2015. But you can just slowly see it trending, the death of the flea market. I only go like once a month, if that, at this point. It's incredible. I used to call you and bother you every Sunday. Hey, this is what I got. I picked up a handheld game.
I was just to say, you haven't called me and woken me up on a Sunday in a long time.
I don't wake you up anymore. Unless I used to ask you if you wanted stuff. Yeah. And 90% of the time, you're like, no.
Bonnie will go with you.
I'm going to go with Bonnie.
Yeah.
My pal, Bonnie. So I'm a little bit older. I'm not sure about wiser. I don't have the energy I used to. But then again, I think it's just because 2015 and 16 were so stressful. But, I still have that same youthful resolve that I had before. I'm just hoping that maybe the nastiness, maybe I should let the nastiness out more this year in 2017. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
You're supposed to get less nasty.
No, I don't know about that. I think I'm going to turn to the old curmudgeon that starts just keeping the people's wiffle balls that come on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, you could start shaking the cane.
Oh, you start shaking the cane.
Yeah, I feel like I've already started doing that.
With the podcast, or?
Yeah, just in general.
Just in general?
Yeah, I just shake the cane a lot.
Yelling at clouds?
Yeah. Old man yells at cloud.
Well, you're a couple years younger than me.
Yeah.
And your birthday's August.
9th.
Ninth. Okay. So that's what screws me up. Since you're the 9th, I'm the 9th. Someone else I know is the 9th. And then my girlfriend is not the 9th. It's close to the 9th, though. But it's just a couple days off. It screws it up for everyone else. Because then I'm trying to see which one is not the 9th.
One of our mutual pals is the 8th. Yeah, there's
don't tell me that. Everyone's screwing around the same time.
There's
9 months before.
There's a lot of birthdays in that first.
A lot of August. Sex going on after the first weekend of the month. You know, I don't know. Ian.
Yeah. Sorry. I feel like shit.
I know.
We got some news.
We got the new news. The new Nintendo 2DS XL that's new.
And it's beautiful. It's a gorgeous thing. So Nintendo never content to stop with new iterations of their hardware.
Especially handhelds.
Especially their handhelds. And I think in an interesting statement, which is to say that, you know, the 3DS family is here for at least another year, especially with the lineup they've been showing game-wise, announced that they are releasing the new Nintendo 2DS XL.
New.
And it's gorgeous. It's fantastic. So the big difference between the previous... Shut up. The previous difference between...
My birthday. And I can't play the damn music again.
Just mute your computer every time.
Well, it's a Miller Lite commercial. I don't want to go on.
All right.
God damn it, IGN.
So the big difference is between the previous 2DS and the new Nintendo 2DS XL. One doesn't have that sweet wedge of bread shape anymore.
Well, let's back up, because if you don't get confused. New means that it was the upgrade to the original 3DS.
Yes, right.
And 3D. First there was a new 3DS, then the new 3DS XL. New just
no,
means...
No.
There wasn't a new regular 3DS?
Let me break it down.
Okay.
Okay? 3DS. 3DS XL. 2DS... New 3DS XL.
They skipped the new 3DS.
They skipped it here, except for limited editions.
Limited edition, but they did have it though somewhere. Okay.
Yeah.
So what that means is it was slightly faster software.
Slightly faster, slightly faster processor. That was on the new 3DS stuff. So now we're talking about the new 2DS. Let me name my bullet points, okay?
Okay. No, you're bullet
points. Original 2DS. Cheaper. No hinge to break.
It was like a tablet-looking thing.
Yeah, like a tablet-looking thing. It had, obviously, the biggest thing was no stereoscopic 3D. This was to bring the price down, and it was a perfect move by Nintendo at the time to release this for the holiday season when Pokemon X and Y came out.
And plus, for children, children might screw up their eyes if too much 3D.
That as well. And it also was a super, like, cheap entry point at $99.99 as opposed to $199, which was what was happening at the time, was what the 3DS XLs were going for at the time. So now we get the new 2DS XL. It has all of the benefits of the new 3DS XL, including the faster processor, the C-Stick, it actually rearranges where the memory card is so that you don't have to open up the back of your new 2DS XL to upgrade your memory card. You can just pop it back in the bottom again. It has a deeper cartridge slot so that it's less likely to eject while it's in a bag or something like that.
Was that a problem sometimes? Hit the button by accident?
Hey, if you were a silly person who didn't put it in a protective case. Yeah.
That's very judgmental, I feel, Ian, but okay.
I said they were silly.
That's judgmental.
Well, they are if you're not putting a breakable, if you're not putting it in a case. Okay. But it's very, very sleek. By getting rid of the 3D, which at this point, almost no one... I mean, most people use it as a novelty and never really used it.
How many games actually required a 3D element?
Well, none of them required it.
I thought there were some portions of some games that you really needed a 3D part.
No, there were games that made great use of it.
But it wasn't required.
It wasn't required.
Okay.
Yeah, like everyone says, Link Between Worlds used the 3D very well, but it was not required. You did need the 3DS XL. You need the XL or the new part.
The new, you need the faster
new, the new part for something like Xenoblade Chronicles.
Yes. Okay.
So you get all that benefit, and by taking away the 3D that people basically don't really use, Nintendo barely uses it. They didn't even put it in Sun and Moon, I don't think. Or if they did, it's minimal. I know they used it very minimally in X and Y. You have a much thinner top screen. So one of the big problems I think people complained about with the XL, and which is why I moved down to the new Nintendo 3DS size and not the new Nintendo 3DS XL, fuck all this, is because it was so top-heavy.
Sure.
So now you have a much sleeker, slimmer design.
Okay, let's back up a bit. When they announced the 3DS, you're coming, you know, hot off of the regular DS, which did fantastic. You had the DS Lite, which is the de facto version of that, which everyone loved, right?
Yeah.
Which what I had, everyone had. 3DS is a cooler name versus upgrade to DS. It built
DSU.
In the 3D sort of... gimmick, and it was a gimmick at the time, 5-6 years ago. Going back, I went to CES 2010.
3D TVs
were all the rage in like 2010, 2011. They tried to push them for a couple of years. No one fucking bought them for two reasons. One, they were really expensive. Two, they didn't work properly. You had to be positioned in the right space in the room with the fucking glasses on. Third, everyone just got done upgrading in the late 2000s. To the brand new LCD LED TVs. Not even LEDs were out, even really. Yeah, LCDs. So then you got to throw away that TV and buy a nice $2,500 3D TV. No, didn't work. But at the time, also in movie theaters, Avatar came out in 2009. 3D movies made a comeback. 3D movies were seen as, oh, it's cool again. Look at this technology. Go in the theaters. And we all went and saw some 3D movies. Oh, yeah, it's cool. But it was, by and large, a gimmick. 3D, even 3D movies have sort of died out. It used to be even a couple years ago that the amount of showings for something like Guardians of the Galaxy, there were more 3D showings than regular. If you look now, regular showings have come back. People did not buy into 3D as much as the marketers wanted you to, I think.
Right.
So I think Nintendo recognized that after a few years and realized, you know what, it's cool to have the name 3DS, but are people using the 3D after the 3DS? I never used it when I used my 3DS, or rarely did.
I turned it on. I would always turn it on, like, to see how well it was done in a game, or if I saw a level that looked like it would be particularly cool looking in 3D, I would play it. But if I used it 20% of the time, I would be surprised.
Which is why I guess this appeals to a lot of people, because no one, you drop the 3D part, no one cares. I don't care. You drop the price to $150, which, by the way, is half the price of the Switch. So Nintendo's sort of hedging their bets against, very few people are saying the Switch is too expensive nowadays. I think that the price point's perfect for what it is.
I think it's fine.
But this is going to bridge that gap, which we can get into earlier, or get into later, that we both thought about and even discussed off air, was that this is going to keep the system alive for another year, maybe a year and a half. You have those third-party developers to give them a chance to get out their final games on this platform before they take all their games in and go to the Switch and have you have that one unified platform probably for the next 5-6 years.
Right.
After that point, it's a natural fit. And then you will get to that point, give it a couple years, 3 years, where you have your mini Switch potentially. So if people think that the regular Switch is too big to put around in their silly kids in their bags and not protecting them, the mini Switch will eventually probably come out, which will be smaller, one piece, and that'll replace something like the 2DS at some point. That's my opinion. I think that could be a possibility.
Yes.
Now, it's not going to have the same touch features and stuff, but, I mean, at the end of the day, you can get around that stuff and work around that. Or maybe they'll come out with a mini Switch that does it. I don't know. The whole point is that this is going to be the bridge, I think, to just the unified Switch. Mm-hmm. I don't see they're coming out with a replacement to this anytime soon. Me, personally, I don't see that.
Yeah, I really don't. I don't think they do either. I think now that the Switch is out in people's hands and they're seeing how people are using it, and now that I've talked to more people, you know, I use it as a portable. Other people have used it almost entirely as a console. I think they realize that they would be fracturing the base maybe of the Switch. If I would imagine someone at Nintendo is looking at it right now and going, okay, yes, this risk of a unified console is actually maybe going to work out for us. But this is obviously their safety just to see for the next year to see what happens.
Oh, sure. I mean, if it wasn't for the 3DS during the Wii U period,
yeah,
Nintendo would have sold nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would have been the end of Nintendo. No, not the end, but it would have been a bad few years and some people thrown off of boards and off of buildings.
Yeah. Would have been the ramen years.
The ramen years at Nintendo of Japan?
Yeah.
They close out the cafeteria, pass out cup of noodle to everyone.
Yeah, it's just cup of noodle.
So I'm interested in this because I did not have a new 3DS or new 3DS XL. I do like the colors. We're getting the neon blue one,
the blue and black. I like the white and orange.
I'm gonna call it the creamsicle colors.
Yeah.
I do like the creamsicle. That's coming out, I think, in Asian regions.
Japan and it's in Japan and I think Australia.
Why don't they give us the choice, or is they probably gonna do 14 different limited editions that are gonna get scalped?
Who knows. I won't be getting one, though. It's sad. I really like the way it looks, but I just upgraded to the new Nintendo 3DS non-XL. Fuck the naming.
It's a really bad name.
Yeah.
But this is one of the reasons why that you think they're not going to be producing any Classic Edition anymore. They want to focus on other...
And it's kind of what I've said from day one. Nintendo is not... It's not an infinite... They don't have infinite space, infinite production lines. There had to have been some reason why they said they weren't doing it. At the time, this was an unknown product, and now that this product is announced, I think it makes perfect sense. They've just got other shit on their plate, and this is not something that they care about right now. Well, and that's not to apologize for it, because, like I said in the last one, they did a horrible job of communicating with the public, but this is why they can't. They're not just not doing it to not do it.
Let's put it this way. If the 3DS was dead and gone, let's just say it came out a couple years sooner, there was no replacement, and there wasn't another product coming out, so you basically just had the Switch and nothing else, then maybe they'd be more likely to say, okay, let's put the proper resources into getting this NES Classic done correctly into people's hands that want it more. But being that the Switch is doing well beyond their expectations, they have a new 2DS out. Even though the NES Classic would still make them money, it's not worth their time in comparison, which to me and you is insane to think about. But to them, that's just how they're doing business in their weird way.
It makes perfect sense to me. I understand why it pisses people off. It's upsetting to me from that aspect, but it also makes sense. Sometimes you just have to look at business coldly.
Nintendo is doing just fine. One of the reasons why...
It's because they know what they're doing.
Well, no, that was a segue, Ian.
Oh.
But Mario Kart 8 Deluxe comes out. It comes out at the end of April, right?
Yeah.
And people are like, there's no games on this system to buy besides Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which has an attach rate of like 100% to the system, which is insane. Mm-hmm. That's insane. I bought it before getting the system. Maybe that's why it was over. People are like, oh, I'm going to get the Amazon Prime discount before I get the system.
Bonnie goes, who does that? And I was like, Pat?
Yeah, I want to save $13. There's no reason not to.
I said Pat bought it before he bought the system. She goes, okay.
Well, yes! I'm not a weirdo. I mean, I am, but not for that reason. So, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe comes out. You've had a chance to play it. I have not yet. But from all scores, I'm on Metacritic. It has a Metascore of 92 out of 100. I guess that's pretty good. I guess it's like their version of Rotten Tomatoes. But all the reviews are like, yeah, it's as awesome as Mario Kart 8 was on the Wii U, but now more gooder. Because graphics are better. There's more play modes. You have double items. You have a proper battle mode, which was one of the big errors of the original. And you get all the DLC from the original for one price.
So, yeah, the proper battle mode is a huge addition, and is a lot of fun. It's got the Shine Thief mode. It's got your traditional balloon mode, although they handle it a little bit differently. They have a cops and robbers mode that I don't actually recall ever playing. That's pretty cool. It wasn't just a tacked on thing where they were just like, okay, let's shuffle this in. They really did pay attention to doing the battle mode very well and making it feel like this is the big addition to buying the deluxe.
Sure.
The deluxe edition. This is the meat for the people who have already purchased this game before, I think. This is the big additional chunk. And they did a great job of doing that, and making it feel like a very significant extra portion. And the battle courses are big. They do up to 12 people, and even when you're doing against CPU, they're so big, I believe you can't even turn the CPU players off because the courses are so big. You'd just be hunting each other down forever, trying to find each other when playing them.
So I think what Mario Kart 8 Deluxe tells me, and it's sort of the story of the Switch itself, is that the Wii U was a lost generation for Nintendo consoles.
For a ton of players.
It was sort of like the public was either not aware of it at large, or was barely aware of it and didn't care, or they chose to skip it because they weren't attracted to it. And the Switch comes out and blows away expectations of sales. Nintendo is now doubling the amount they're going to try to produce, from 8 million to 16 million for this year. And they'll probably sell all 16 million of those, most likely.
If it keeps up like this,
The way it trends. Because so far, shipments come in, they're gone. Shipments come in, they're gone. Basically, that's what happened with the Wii. And no, it's not artificial scarcity. That's not what it is. People are just buying them quicker than Nintendo anticipated it. And you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, this is a shitty system, no one wants it, artificial scarcity, but they're selling out, and Nintendo's making more and getting them into stores quickly. When I went to my Target when the day Mario Kart 8 came out, there was at least 20 to 30 consoles there.
Yeah.
And I went a week later, they were all gone.
And that's the thing. It's getting easier to get them. The people I know who want them did not have to pay scalpers. They have them in their hands. They did not pay overpriced. They maybe had to wait a month and a half, some of them, to find one like you. But basically, everyone I know who wants one now has one and did not have to jump through an exceptional amount of hoops to get one, if they were patient. And that means that, unlike the Wii, the supply is not as... They're getting them out there fast enough. So if they're still selling out, then that means the demand is... They're selling because people want them.
Yeah, it's not a scarcity thing. If scalpers can't get more than, I think last time I checked, 370, that's very little profit on a $300 system after you include taxes.
You're making about $50.
At most.
Yeah.
And that's if you're selling it locally. If you're selling on eBay, you're not making much of anything. Mm-hmm. And of course, your mileage may vary, but at this point, I think scalpers lose. At this point, 2 months in, they lose. But what's important is that Mario Kart 8 appeals to the public that much more than Legend of Zelda. Yes, Legend of Zelda is a popular franchise. We know that. It's not a killer app the same way Mario Kart 8 is. It just isn't. It's not on the same scale. If it's a tier 2 killer app, we'll just say Mario Kart is the top. Mario Kart's the one that five-year-olds can play easily, adults can play, party game. It's sort of the mixture of everything. It's racing, it's quick arcade experience, it has the cute, lovable characters we all love. It's pretty much one of the most brilliant inventions Nintendo came up with, probably, in terms of having a franchise.
I think they're equal, and I think now that Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is out, and I thought this when the Switch came out, and my fears have been unfounded, but at the time I was like, if only 8 Deluxe was coming out with it, this would look so much healthier, because then you've got your meaty single player experience, and now you've also got your meaty multiplayer experience, and now they do have both of those, and this is why I think now the purchases of the Switch are only going to go up. How much things have changed since launch in my head too. Remembering how I was talking about how you call it the optics of it. I've never thought of that term, but how I looked at the library and the launch. There's, you know, four good physical titles to pick up on the system now, at least. Puyo Puyo vs. Tetris, which is probably the best puzzle game I've played, I mean, ever or in recent memory. You got Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You've got Zelda. And Bomberman Oz is very good.
1-2 Switch.
1-2 Switch is fun, but I mean, no one needs
I'm
to
just
go
saying,
buy
right
1-2 Switch.
Right now, you have about 5 or 6 core games that are being pushed. And then you include Just Dance 2017. Again, that's weak overall. But again, we're looking at March to early May of a system being released. And this is, in terms of release structures of systems, 3DS was in a similar spot, and it was in a much worse spot when the 3DS came out. There was nothing to buy on a 3DS when it first came out.
And we're only getting closer to the June release of ARMS and the July release of Splatoon 2.
Sure. And then what else comes up in the fall? But what's important to me, again, this is all anecdotal. When I went to my Target a week afterwards, just to check, all right, I bought finally my Neon Wii U, my Neon Switch the week before. I just wanted to see what was there left. No systems were left, and the spot, they didn't have the little placards out for the price. It was just barren. Then I looked at the game section. There was maybe two copies of each game left. So Mario Kart was almost sold out. Probably two or three left. There was more than the other games. Breath of the Wild had maybe one or two left. But even like 1-2 Switch had one or two left. And even Just Dance 2017 had like one or two left. Which I thought was surprising. So that means that people are hungering for games. And Nintendo put out, I think they may not even wanted to realize that they hit some sort of weird sweet spot for, we know you're hungry for games, and there's not a lot out there, so you're just going to buy whatever's out there right now. They might have stumbled upon something that didn't happen to 3DS. No one went out and bought those launch 3DS titles. No one gave a shit about them. They said, we want titles. Give us real games.
Yeah.
They figured it out with really two major games in the first 6 weeks, and then some filler titles. And if you want to say, yeah, Bomberman's a great title, how many people really like Bomberman in the grand scheme of things? I mean, that's not going to move a system by itself. That's like a second or third title you get as an extra. That's the Ikari Warriors I got for Christmas with all my NES. It's like, yeah, I'll play that game, but I really want to play, you know, a Super Mario Brothers. Yeah.
I'm just excited for when we get to the summer and we start seeing things that haven't already been released. Sure. Is basically what I'm looking forward to. Because back to, you know, the topic here, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe thoughts.
High selling rate, 45% of Switch owners picked up the game.
That's
according to this article. That's a big attach rate.
It is Mario Kart 8. And it's hard for me to think on it. You gotta look at it from two ways. I am just playing Mario Kart 8. And I'm falling in love with it all over again. But at the end of the day, and it's nice to have everything unlocked, but, you know, it's definitely a double dip. It's great that I can lay in bed and play it. I mean, the portability aspect of it is fantastic. Looks great. It runs great. It's still a fantastic game. Obviously, the people who are going to be most impressed by this, I think, are the people who never really got a chance to play this before, because it's like diving into Scrooge McDuck's money bin.
But that's what's important.
There's just so much there.
If we follow the trail from the Wii and... What?
All right, I'm going to get my Sherlock Holmes cap.
No, I'm just following the through line of Mario Kart in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
So on the Wii, Mario Kart Wii was the highest selling title at almost 40 million. I think it was like 38.
Okay.
All right? And that's at about 100 million consoles sold. That's like 40% attach rate, which is gigantic.
Yeah.
When you go up to 100, down to 40. Then you go to the woeful Wii U, which had, what, 10 or 11 million consoles. But out of that, people were dying for a game to play, and so the Mario Kart 8 Wii U sales were 7.37 million.
Hmm.
They were dying for something to play, but that showed you that 40 million down to 7.3, okay?
Yeah.
Now you come out with a console that people might actually want to buy who didn't want a Wii U, the Switch, and they see this game, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, out, or they're like, holy shit, I haven't played a Mario Kart game in 10 years since I played it on my, you know, on the Wii. I'm just saying that's potential that could happen. Now they're back in the game again. And that itself could help float the Switch for until the end of the year when Super Mario Odyssey comes out, and that'll just, you know, blow it out the door for like probably until the first few months of 2018.
Right.
So Nintendo's in a good spot. I mean, they are.
There are some annoying things about Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, such as you haven't played it. So there's auto driving assist, which is turned on automatically at the beginning. And you have to turn it off.
What does that do? Make sure you stay on the road?
Yeah, but it's really just...
Bumpers in bowling?
Yeah, and I believe that tilt controls are automatically on for additional players. Either that or it's very easy to turn on like this. Driving assist, auto acceleration, tilt controls. Yeah, there's some weird stuff with that. Right now, you can't queue up like you used to be able to get into a room. It just boots you out with an error and says you can't
All right, you got those bugs. So
there's some little problems.
Do you like having two items back again?
Yes, it's not like Double Dash though, but yes, I do like having two items.
Well, two drivers are stupid.
No, yeah, right, I didn't like the two drivers. But yeah, you can't switch back and forth, but I very much do like having two items.
You have a backup.
Yes.
Backup item. So you get the second item. Do you use the second item first? The one you just got first you have to use, or is it still the first one you got?
It's the one that you had it's the one that you've had the longest.
You use that one first.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's not as bad.
It's really nice having two items back again. That's one of the minor additions that I like a ton.
And you can use some strategy when you do that. You can say, okay, I got a banana, let's get a red shell too to sort of have some defense or something. And then of course, do you like them taking out the fire hopping?
I never got good enough to really know how to do that.
I could do it a little bit, but to me, it breaks the game when you only have a very small amount of people that can do an advanced trick like that. That's really a bug that they're exploiting. Yeah. So I have no problem taking it out.
No, I don't
have no problem.
I don't have issues with that either.
Sure. So I'm going to get it. Well, I do have it. I bought it before it came out. No. I primed it, and so I'll play it with you. And, yeah. So, here's happy sales to, I guess, the Switch so far? I don't know. Breath of the Wild DLC, though. Sticking with the Switch. Have you played Breath of the Wild?
Not at all. Won't touch it until I finish some other games.
Okay. Probably a good thing, because you can get absorbed in it. And I have played about 12 to 15 hours, probably.
Bonnie has about 140.
Holy shit. Okay, so you can see how immersive it is. And has she done everything in those 140 hours?
No, you should try looking at some of the people you're friends with online, because it'll give them their hour rates. A lot of our friends are now close to, like, closing into 200 hours.
It's scary big. I mean, it took me, because I didn't realize the guy with the axe that helps you chop the tree down, it tells you, was sleeping at the time. It took me a good 4 hours to get off the plateau because of that. It probably would have taken me like 2.5, 3 if I wasn't running around for a fucking hour. Like, where the hell is the last shrine? But that 4 hours, though, is basically a tutorial. Mm-hmm. A giant tutorial.
I'm aware of that, yeah.
Talking to other people as well.
No, I know.
So that just shows you how huge this is. Most tutorials in games are like 10 minutes, 15 minutes long. And it gives you... But you can just get lost in that tutorial area, and then... By the time I got into, you know, like 6-7 hours, and oh, I got my first wild horse, and it's like, oh, you know, and then you talk to people, that personalities, and then, you know, you go to the village, and half the girls want to have sex with Link, which is kind of weird, but okay. And then it's a burgeoning world, it really is. And I'm not even probably, 10% into the game at that point? I don't know.
Right.
You know, and I'm like 10, 12 hours into it. That's why I'm not... When people say there's DLC announced for Zelda, that's why I didn't freak out. Because this isn't the sort of game where you had to get the DLC to experience a huge world.
Mm-mm.
You can get lost in this game. You can try to find all the... What is there, like 100 shrines or whatever that are splayed about? Mm-hmm. You can probably never even get to like a good chunk of those and get lost and still enjoy the game.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So this isn't a game where you feel cheated not getting the DLC, in my opinion. In so far, me playing it for like 12 hours and still not realizing I even cracked the surface of the game.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a DLC pack that is necessary. Although there does seem like there are some nice things they add to it.
The Master Trial.
Originally there. So it looks like it's going to add a couple of things. One looks actually pretty cool to me, called the Trial of the Sword. Which is a series of cage matches with Link needing to fight through around 45 rooms.
Steel cage match?
In total. but without any armor or weapons to start. So, sounds very roguelike to me in that you basically get, seems like one shot, but you have to upgrade your armor and your weapons as you go through the different fights.
So not so much a survival mode, or
yeah, kind of like a 45 room survival mode is what it seems like. And the reward is a permanently powered up Master Sword. There's also a new hard mode that ranks up all the enemies to different power levels, almost like how in Mario 1 when you beat it, the Goombas turn into Buzzy Beetles.
Buzzy Beetles. They recover health, the enemies, in hard mode, which is interesting.
They also will have better eyesight and hearing, and live on hot air balloons floating around Hyrule.
Okay, that's... What, are they going to just dive bomb on you?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that last one's a bit of an outlier, the article says, but by successfully reaching these planks, players can battle enemies and collect treasure. So apparently you can ride around in the hot air balloons. But the most exciting feature in this one is big, and I feel weird about them charging for this.
So like, do
they,
I.
They know it should have been, it should have been in the fucking game. I was astounded by when everyone told me, no, it's just simply not in there. Oh, no, this one is fine. I'm not, okay, so the hero's path is interesting. So, it will show you a path that you've taken over the past 200 hours of play, so you can kind of track how you've walked. That's interesting to me. The one that I'm not so thrilled about, not just being an update, is called the Travel Medallion, which is fast travel, which is in every single game like this. And the fact that it's being bundled in with DLC and not as part of an obvious update is kind of annoying to me.
Well, there is the fast travel through the shrines.
Right, but not anywhere else.
No, but shrines are placed fairly close to a lot of things in the game, though, so far.
Okay. Right.
I mean, it's not like every area has multiple shrines.
I only know what I've heard from Vani, and yes, there is a lot of shrines.
But you have to defeat them first to use them.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the key. That's sort of the impetus to going into, because you don't have to go into the shrines.
Right.
The only other impetus going into the shrines, past the ones off the first plateau, is to get the little, you get
orbs.
Four orbs to update your stamina or your total number of hearts.
Right.
But then besides that, once you defeat it, you can teleport anywhere on the map where you are to one of those shrines.
Okay. So it's not that big of a deal.
No, but the hero's path, to me, that's cheap putting that as DLC to me. That's where I'm going to be a little critical. That's such a small thing they could have put in the game as something you had to either find yourself, that you put on your tablet, that maybe you have to venture somewhere, you know what I mean? Like, that's something I think that to me is a little cheesy, that part of it. That's something that's a little cheesy for me, but again, that's one of the larger, you know, that's one of a larger package, so it's not like you're paying $5 just for that.
Right.
So it's going to be, what, $19.99 for this. To me, that's reasonable, and you also get, let's see, there's other clothes in the game and other stuff. You can get the creepy tingle outfit. So there you go, if you want to do that. I think it's not a bad deal for $20, just because, again, if you don't get this stuff, you can still enjoy the game. The game is fucking huge. I'm afraid to play it. Just because one of those games is going to draw me in, and like I said, I spent like 4 hours playing it one Saturday morning. I was like, okay, I got to stop because I can play it forever. I can just go and start taming horses for 3 hours, you know, and name them Lucy and Michelle. You know, I don't, you know, like, it's just one of those sort of games where you can get lost. And yes, and of course, there's been other open world games, but I think for Zelda, the magic and sort of
there's a difference. Nintendo does it.
The majesty around sort of the story of Zelda, I think, brings it to me that other level versus running around in a fake LA shooting people in the face.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a little bit difference between those two sort of motifs.
Okay, yes.
Ian, a little bit of YouTube news.
Okay.
We originally spoke about Disney buying Maker Studios, one of the larger MCNs on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
Multi-channel network.
That's why we're so gray. We've been doing that. We were around for the birth of the purchase, and now we're around for the death.
And that was in April 2014 for almost $1 billion. It was $950 million.
Fucking insane.
At the time, we surmised, at least I did. You probably agreed that this was a long play from Disney.
Yes.
To basically get into the game from their perspective easily and cheaply. To get into the YouTube world, get into the digital
buying a pre-made base,
buying an entity that already exists, not have to worry about investing in their own infrastructure, getting their own employees, getting their own quote unquote YouTube influencers. We buy a base, we have something to start with and play with now.
It's like bullion.
Yes, sure. And to us, $1 billion is pocket change to Mickey. Mickey's like, $1 billion. I don't know.
Expensive bullion.
So now it's come to pass that they're kind of rolling up Maker Studios, and now it's the sort of the Disney Digital Network.
Yeah,
right.
Yes, and yeah. So it, you know, didn't seem like it was particularly great for them. The article said it's donezo. So what they're doing is they're rolling it up. Polaris is still allowed.
Polaris is a namesake for the gaming sort of
right.
part of Maker Studios. That's going to still exist, But in terms of Maker as an entity, that's pretty much washed away.
Right.
And they're going to keep up to 300 channels on the network. But it sounds like what they want to basically do is use them to push Disney products, Disney entities, Disney IPs, which does make sense.
It's in-market advertising. In-network? In-network advertising, basically. And then they're going to start using the, you know, this new Disney network to use for, like, YouTube. They also want to do portable, like, iPhone stuff. They want to do short format shows. They want to do short video. And basically, you're going to start seeing stuff like Science and Star Wars, an episodic series that explores and explains, you know, science, fantasy, Star Wars, and real science. Disney IRL, whatever that is. Iconic animated Disney characters to real life. Disney Design Challenges, Disney Magical Starts. There's a lot of Disney.
Let's go through some of these. Might as well. On Oh My Disney, digital destination for a daily dose of Disney, capturing the zeitgeist through a Disney lens.
Oh, the zeitgeist.
Disney Style, exploring the intersection of Disney stories and characters with what's trending in fashion, nail art, hairstyles, and cosmetics. Disney Family, aiming to bring parents and kids through Disney crafts and do-it-yourself projects, recipes, and activities featuring Mouse House characters and stories. I guess that's what the term is for Mickey and Friends album. Mouse House?
I guess.
Babble, parenting community site where contributors share their experiences and give readers a forum to bond and learn. Polaris from Maker, featuring original content from a community of gaming personalities, including talk shows, animation, and games-to-life content. And StarWars.com and the Star Wars app, the digital destinations for all things related to the galaxy far, far away. The network programs content for Star Wars fans of all ages across social and digital platforms. And they have shows, Science and Star Wars, Oh My Disney, Club Mickey Mouse, Disney in Real Life, Coin, animated action comedy on Maker's Polaris with game-inspired aesthetic that follows a team of misfits tasked to save the world. All right.
I love it whenever the zeitgeist is captured through certain lenses.
Yes. Disney Design Challenge and Disney Magical Starts. So they have a mission. This was, to me, always their goal.
Yes.
I think for the first couple years, they wanted to see how this sort of played out with their purchase. Does that make sense? Unfortunately, when they first purchased Maker, you had the Starcade sort of show going on with JonTron,
mm-hmm.
where originally, according to my sources, was supposed to be at least a couple dozen shorts series of JonTron doing basically reviewing every single Star Wars game in order to lead up to the release of The Force Awakens.
Right,
and we lined up kind of that in December of 2000, and was it 2015 or 14? I forget. But anyway, that was lined up and planned. You had a bunch lined up. They only, I think, produced about 7 of those out of those. And
I thought that was supposed to be a lot more than that.
Supposed to be a lot more. So I think Disney's first sort of look into the YouTuber world wasn't a positive one, because there's no way they made their money back on that adventure.
No.
They made an entire huge Millennium Falcon set. You had a whole team of writers, editors, special effects, working with John. I'm not sure what John got paid. Probably was a decent amount. So what you had then was Disney trying to say, okay, let's see what the influencers on YouTube can do. And I don't think it paid dividends for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that was that sort of investment could have led to this decision, but probably could have colored it a bit to say, okay, what do we have here?
Well, it was also mentioned that, you know, when it came to looking at what was actually produced, it was entirely inefficient. Mm-hmm. That they were looking at what they were making, and it was costing more and coming out less quality than what they were expecting to see.
Well, sure, it's always an investment. So if I'm going to invest all this money into this program, and spend potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I'm making back pennies on the dollar, and people already know about Star Wars anyway.
Yeah.
Like, I would not have needed to invest that money to begin with. So I'm really just losing. I'm just wasting money and resources at this point. Versus buying in, like we said, buying into influencers that have millions and millions of possibly a billion more collectively of subscribers. Now let's work with those partners or have them come in the shows that we want to do.
Right.
That may not even be Star Wars related, but just Disney in general. And then, of course, now we own Marvel. Now we own Star Wars. And we can sort of sprinkle that in when we need it.
Right.
It's sort of, it's almost like the new Disney Channel, but it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Does the Disney Channel still exist on TV?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it won't matter in the future because kids growing up are just going to be on their iPads looking at, you know, YouTube Disney and not the Disney Channel on TV. So there you have it. And all these, for the most part, all these people that are going to be cut from Maker, they're going to land on their feet elsewhere. Other MCNs are going to scoop them up if they haven't done it already. So they're not going to lose out. It's just sort of Disney taking their investment and sort of refining, I think, to what they originally wanted to, you know, do it with.
Yeah, I think this was kind of a telegraph.
This episode of the CU Podcast, Ian, is sponsored by the Frame Savers Podcast at www.theframesavers.com. Are you a fan of retro video games, but just don't have enough time to play them all? That's like, I don't have time to play all these games on the dusty-ass shelf.
No.
You could if you just learn to go fast. And the Frame Savers is a retro video game podcast that can help. Listen as Chad and John review some of your favorite games, like Final Fantasy VII, Super Mario Brothers, The Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, along with some of the worst games ever made, Bubsy 3D, Wand of Gamelion, ooh, that was a CDI Zelda game, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, oof. Each episode, Chad and John discuss one game, diving into the history of it, discussing their experiences, playing, and telling you how the top speedrunners speedrun them. Wow. Hear interviews from such streamers as Super Mario Brothers world record holder Darbian. We brought him up before in the podcast.
Nice.
And learn all about how all the cool tricks and glitches you have seen actually happen. The Frame Savers has a little bit for everyone, from the gaming historian to the collector to the casual player and speedrunner. The Frame Savers can be found at www.theframesavers.com and on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and anywhere else podcasts are downloaded. So show some love to the fellas at the Frame Savers.
Thanks.
Hey, Ian, you're laughing at this, but you won't be laughing for long. You saw Stranger Things?
No, I haven't.
You got to check it out. It's the hottest Netflix series. It takes place in 83. It's like Stephen King-esque. Well, Loot Crate had a really cool t-shirt last month.
Oh, that right looks here. Actually pretty awesome. I like the color tone.
If you're listening to this, you're not watching it. It's a pretty cool shirt from Stranger Things. Ian, you have a figure in the last month's...
And these are actually, I like these. It's the, they're the Q figs, which are very nicely done. They're very, like, stylized, almost old-timey looking.
And that's Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones.
And that was, that was last month's Loot Crate.
Kicking down a wall.
So this month is Guardians for Loot Crate. You know? The Guardians is going to include Guardians of the Galaxy 2 stuff, Star Wars, Destiny, and the Goonies. I mean, come on. So you have until the 19th at 9 p.m. to sign up at lootcrate.com/Pat, enter code Pat, P-A-T, to save 10% off any new subscription, if you want to go and do that.
I want the Goonies stuff.
Goonies! I'm actually looking forward to that. I want to see what... I mean, Goonies is a franchise that they've been rumored to do the sequel for like 10 years now. Well, no. Dick Donner will do fine. He'll do fine with the sequel. Richard Donner. He'll be fine. But there's always some good stuff. You see me wearing usually the Power Rangers green and white Ranger t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
The t-shirts are always quality, honestly, by themselves. You know, you get a good amount of value there for a low price. Oh, I'm going to give that. There's a Batman color-changing mug. I'll probably give that to Frank. He'll probably get a kick out of that. So, Ian, you like Loot Crate.
I do. I like the pin that came this month or last month too.
Oh sure, and there's also though if you want to check out the Loot Gaming, it's a teeny bit more money, but you get a lot of value in it, and it's Road Rage coming at you with an exclusive Tracer cute but deadly figure is going to be in the new Loot Gaming crate. I don't have it on me to show you that, unfortunately, and there's going to be an Assassin's Creed shirt. So it's your choice, whatever you want. It's gonna be Destiny, Rocket League, Twisted Metal, Mario Kart in this month's Loot Gaming, over a $60 value for less than $25 a month. You can get that as well. Just go to lootcrate.com/Pat, enter code Pat when you check out, and save 10%. Thanks, Loot Crate, for being a proud sponsor of the CU Podcast. And finally, Ian, you need to shave. You need to shave, Ian.
Not shaving.
You know how you can use a good razor? I shaved my beard.
Mm-hmm.
You know what helped get the job done? Dollar Shave Club.
Oh.
Helped get the job done.
Could they cut through this for us, you think?
Why don't you try it?
It's only a dollar, right?
It's a dollar. You go to dollarshaveclub.com/CU podcast. You get 1 month membership for only a dollar with free shipping. No commitments. You can cancel anytime. So I got the executive razor, and it came with four cartridges, and it was a smooth shave.
Made you handsomer, too.
Maybe more handsome?
More handsome.
More gooder, more handsomer? Handsomer?
More hammy.
More hammy?
Yes.
It's a fine razor. You can use it on your face, but other body parts probably as well.
Yeah.
It doesn't specify where you can and cannot use the razor.
Need to shave your butt. Shave your butt.
You got a tough unibrow out there. You want to take care of that. I had one in high school. We all did.
Yeah.
Take care of it. Get the job done. Got some bad neck hair sprouting up. Some calf hair. I guess
I have a patch of lower back hair.
You have a soul patch?
Yeah.
Get Von and you get that Dollar Shave Club shaver. Get rid of it. You know, it's a good value. It's a good razor. I got it. I can testify to that. Again, go to dollarshaveclub.com/CU podcast. It's only a buck. Free shipping. No commitments. Cancel anytime. But, hey, you may not want to. I'm just saying. Take care of that soul patch on your back.
Cashews anytime.
You want to talk Wolfenstein 3D?
I mean, we can. It's the 25th anniversary, right?
Yeah, it was on May 5th. 1992. That's 25 years, yeah.
Cinco de Killing Nazis.
Do you remember the first time you played Wolfenstein 3D? What your thoughts were? And, you know, you were a youngin', right? You're not even hitting puberty yet, probably.
Even more so, I remember the first time I saw it in a shareware catalog.
See, I never had any shareware catalog. I would just look at what came with the CD-ROM or disc.
Being solicited and looking at it and seeing screenshots and being like, holy shit, I need to play this. Because I hadn't really seen anything like it. And I actually played my first experience with it and its engine was actually... I played a shareware version very soon after of Catacomb 3D, which was the precursor, to Wolfenstein. It was the test engine that I believe John Carmack was using. It was Hover Tank 3D, and I think it was a...
And that was released as an actual game?
Yeah,
and
Catacomb 3D were like his tests using that engine before Wolfenstein came out. And then Wolfenstein came out and was just, you know, so much more. You know, the graphics were better, and there was more meat and potatoes to it. But yeah, that game, you know, I mean, changed the way I looked at what you could do with PC gaming. You know, at that point, I was just used to
games in general. Yes,
yeah,
I'll argue.
Yeah. So it was pretty big. I didn't spend nearly as much time with Wolfenstein as I did Doom later. I don't think I ever played beyond the first shareware chapter of Wolfenstein.
I didn't either when it first came out.
Yeah.
I had my copy, which I tweeted out, was at CompUSA.
I saw.
Escape from World War II prison. Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fun time.
Yeah.
It was on the shelf. Like, when you walked up, you looked to the left. There was a, I forget if it was like a comic book stack, but they have a bunch of shareware titles.
Yeah.
And it was right there. And it was like the MicroStar was the local distributor that got them into CompUSA. I think it was like $5.99 or so. And that was a good value because remember, when you got shareware, that first episode or first part of the game, that was a full game for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, you can probably tear through it like in 25 minutes if you knew where everything is. But when you're getting a game for the first time like that, first of all, there was no games that cost only $5-$6. On computers back then, you're paying still $30 for a game, $40 for a game, and it's revolutionary for a game that cheap to be paying $5-$6 to try out a game like that. And Wolfenstein 3D, it solidified the shareware model that would exist for what, next 3, 4, or 5 years after that. Like,
yeah. And this basically was a game one episode for free, two that you buy, you know, to complete the game.
Oh, sure, and then you can buy the other three, which were the nocturnal missions. Was where when you went after, was it Dr. Faust and the zombies?
Maze, yeah.
But yeah, if you want to kill Hitler, yeah, you got to call that number or mail in your check.
Yeah.
And mail you back the game. Because I got one person say, oh, I can't believe you paid for shareware. Why didn't you just download that? In 92, how the fuck am I going to download that? I didn't have internet in my house until about 95.
I remember, yeah, there was actually an argument we had once in the comments with someone who was like, no, that's not legal. I'm like, no, they charge you for the diskette and the packaging.
They explicitly said, share this. It's shareware. Yeah. Give it to other people because it was marketing to them to buy the full version.
Yeah. but they're not going to give you a disc for free.
No, they don't want to lose money.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
they want to get something back for the disc.
So you download it for free, or you pay the $5 to skip the hassle of downloading it, and you end up with a disc that you can overwrite later if you want to.
And then you can sell on eBay 25 years later for $70, because everyone wants to, for some reason, now buy Wolfenstein 3D shareware. I don't know. It's weird.
Really?
Some of them go for money, honestly, because I guess if they're localized and weird, you know.
That's crazy.
Well, in general, Wolfenstein 3D, I was looking at some of the software. I guess there are some versions that are harder to find, like the actual Apogee version, big box version is hard to find. That goes for a ton of money.
I figured that would probably go for a lot.
Because I don't remember ever seeing that ever.
No.
I would see it re-released or packed in with Doom, you know, a couple years later. But yeah, when you think about ever walking into a CompUSA or Computer City, which was the competitor, and trying to find a version of Wolfenstein 3D that wasn't just shareware, and it's hard to think of that. I do remember seeing like the Mac version coming out a couple years later, and seeing that version.
I don't think I recall ever seeing a PC big box version though.
But why was Wolfenstein 3D so important? It really did two things at a time, which I think scared some people. It made games feel more immersive due to the third-person realism, which, yes, there were third-person games to that point, mostly dungeon crawlers on computers in the 80s. They weren't done like this with real, you know, voice audio sounds, and it didn't have that depiction of violence and blood and shooting people. And I think that combination made people like, holy shit, this is different.
It ratcheted up the level of maturity that people were not expecting to see, I don't think, at that point in video games, that you had only seen a few other times before here and there, you know, and mostly played for shock value, like in things like Chiller.
Oh yeah.
Whereas, you know, Wolfenstein is you know, primitive as it might be by, you know, by today's standards, you know, it was actively woven in as part of the storyline.
And if you try to go back and look at some of the original reviews of the game, that's what they say. It's like it's so immersive that, yes, if you can get past what they said was like almost shocking violence at the time, which now makes you go like, hee hee, shocking violence, but at the time it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for the ESRB. So games are still, at least console games are still for kids, computer games more for adults. So I doubt many kids would have stumbled upon Wolfenstein 3D, 5-year-olds, even though I bought it for myself, but I was a little bit older. I had my allowance money, only cost $6. They didn't, six bucks it cost.
$6.
It cost $6. And I bought it at my CompUSA and enjoyed that first episode. And I played it multiple times. But it did establish, it's cliche, you can go watch certain gaming historians' video about the, you know, how important Wolfenstein 3D was, but it basically established everything we know about first-person shooters. Multiple weapons, you know, health packs, secrets, you know, the structure of room by, or level by level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were things that you took for granted before that this helped solidify. And yes, you got to kill Nazis, and you got to kill Robo-Hitler, if you bought into the episode.
With four chain guns or something like that.
But what was also important was the fact that the game was so easily moddable that you. I remember within a couple years or a year later, you had all these other versions of Doom on shareware. There was a version where, you know, you had TIE fighters flying around you had to shoot. You know what I mean? You probably remember that one. It was so easy just to map your own graphics to the characters and to the walls and put in your own sounds. It was almost like probably how easy it is for now for app games you produce, where you buy the shell and you just plug in your own elements. But that was one of the first games that you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Doom built upon that. But Wolfenstein was really, you know, the first game to make that easy to do. With what were they called? At least on Doom.
Doom, they were WAD files.
WAD files. I'm not sure what they were on Wolfenstein, what they were called.
Yeah, I can't recall. Might have been the same, but I don't think so.
But then, of course, it spawned the glut of first-person shooters. Rise of the Triad was based on a more advanced engine, Wolfenstein engine. They licensed it out for games like Blakestone, which I remember I had the shareware version of that, where every time you shot the guy's arm fell off, which I thought
Rise of the Triad was after Doom, actually. I think that was on a slightly more advanced engine than that, even.
But they're all go back to the Wolfenstein engine, though. Doom was built upon it.
Yeah.
And then you had the game with the ninja, I forget, that had. Then you have Then you have
Duke Shadow Warrior, Shadow Warrior spawned from Duke Nukem. You had the Blood games. You had
That's right, the Blood games.
The first Blood was really good, actually. But you had Hexen. You had Heretic.
I think I played Heretic.
Heretic's the first one. Hexen was the second one with like the hub world.
So think about before Wolfenstein and then Doom a year later, '93. You have a whole new genre of game for the most part that erupts and then pretty much dominates the next decade, going into then, of course, Half-Life in the late 90s. And now we look at first-person shooters, they're like the biggest video game genre. And the genre is only 25 years old. So it's sort of an amazing mini-story to me, Wolfenstein, how imagine games before first-person shooters and afterwards. There really hasn't been that big of a switch, I think, in gaming since then.
No. It also makes me sad, though, because with the rise of it, I remember playing, you know, PC games heavily at the time. It seemed to directly correlate to the death of the PC adventure game as well.
Oh, sure. It didn't help. It absolutely didn't.
I mean, it's not the only cause, but, you know, as soon as stuff like Doom and Wolfenstein came out, you know, everyone's suddenly focusing on that. And I think Doom more than Wolfenstein was kind of the big one that pushed everyone into making first-person shooters, and suddenly, you know, LucasArts games aren't selling anymore, or Sierra. No one cares. Yeah, Sierra games.
Oh, I would say yes, but at the same time, having Doom on the PC opened up so many new gamers to a new platform that weren't there before.
Sure.
People were getting computers in the mid-90s already, but something like having, quote-unquote, a killer app like Doom on it that, you know, the console versions not as good.
No.
You know, and in Wolfenstein, certainly, well, for Wolfenstein, you can make an argument, but not for Doom. You know, the PC version, you know, was great and still good.
Yeah.
You know, very important. Both of those games, obviously, both from good old id Software. Still have my sweatshirt somewhere. So, raise a glass for Wolfenstein 3D, and we'll probably do the same next year for good old Doom. Raise your water. Ian's got his Nestle water, which is probably the worst bottle of water out there, but that's okay. I still love you, Ian. What was your favorite memory of Wolfenstein? You have one particular or no?
Just playing it for the first time, like after, like honestly, like staring at these screenshots in the magazine.
You see the dead guard in front of you?
Yeah, like just playing it like for the first time was honestly my favorite memory, because I don't know. It was very neat to see that.
My Leben!
Yeah, actually, yeah, the voice samples as well.
Halt! All right,
so...
Since my baby left me, I had a new place
to play. So, bear with us here. Bear with us here, folks, while we talk about a very interesting topic. So, the world of Elvis Presley collectibles...
We've talked about Elvis collectibles plenty of times in the podcast.
Yes, we have. We've brought it up almost as many times as Amiibos.
Yes, and a certain Heat game.
Yeah, maybe a book. Elvis collectibles, man. We should really do a best of our Elvis collectibles.
A whole playlist on YouTube.
So Elvis collectibles was a massive market. Elvis was everywhere. I mean.
Collector plates on TV.
You
see, like the Time Life music collections,
the original movies. Sun Records singles, all of the different pressings and records and versions of his music, his movies, his memorabilia, just all of this nonsense, and a lot of it was. I don't care if it's your birthday. A lot of this, you know, would fetch a lot of money in the heyday of Elvis collecting.
80s, 90s.
Yeah, and I would probably say 70s, too. And, for instance, you know, things would go for a lot. You know, the original five Sun singles would, at one point in time, according to this article, fetch, you know, £25,000. I mean, that's an insane amount of money. You know, the original That's All Right record would fetch £4,000. But in recent years, the worth of Elvis merchandise has been plummeting. And it really kind of started to gel and people started to notice around 2015, a one-of-a-kind Elvis acetate was to go to auction, and it was said that it was probably going to sell for about 12,000 pounds, and it only achieved half of that. And when the article writer went to go look into this, the first person he wanted to ask was an expert on Elvis memorabilia, and he found that the collector was, this expert was dead.
Oh, okay.
So this ties into why this set of this sort of this subset of collecting is seeing the value of their collectibles, their Elvis memorabilia, go down. The people who are interested in Elvis collectibles are getting old enough to the point where they're either sadly dying off, or they're not interested in it anymore. And in the instance of them dying off, they are left with these large collections that their families and children need to get rid of when cleaning out the estate. And the markets are getting flooded with Elvis collectibles, and there aren't nearly as many people out there looking for them. So the value of these things are just, you know, they're well, shedding pounds by the days. And a lot of people were looking forward to using these. I mean, they were, you know, this is, people looked at these things sometimes as, this is money that's always going to be worth money, and I'm going to hold on to this.
Collectibles are always going to be worth something at least, so I can hold on to it, then later on, if I get rid of it,
I can sell this, retire, you know, use this, you know, for something else or something another. And, you know, very quickly, it looks like that's not going to be the case for this. They mention something on Discogs, which is interesting, which is, you know, a record collecting website and database. You can do purchases there, but they keep track of how much, like, records have sold over the past, I think it's like 50 copies on a website.
Okay.
And, you know, there are also, you know, how, like, you can buy paper, like buying guides for comics or toys or collectibles. Well, they're kind of being, I mean, that's kind of outdated. A record collecting guide listed one of the Elvis records at being worth $125.
Well, 125 pounds.
125 pounds. On Discogs, it was, it's being shown as averaging like 13 and a quarter, like the past 10 copies having been sold.
So there's a disconnect between these past prices versus where they are today.
Yes.
And you can always just say, well, there's a steep decline. And that's because there's less new collectors maybe getting into it, but the older ones are disappearing.
Yeah.
They're getting older. This has been a hobby for 40 years now, almost, collecting Elvis merchandise. So people that were maybe 30 starting or 40 or 70, 80 are dying.
Yeah.
And what happens when those people die?
Well, it's like I said,
back in the market.
Yeah.
And there isn't a new set of collectors to take their place. What happens to that merchandise? It sits.
Yeah.
Into the void. So why are we talking about this, Ian?
Well, because it because video games.
Because video games.
Because video games. It was an interesting article to read because Pat and I have always had this thought and this feeling, and I'm sure lots of people do too. People who are sitting on these video game collections thinking that they're going to be worth money forever and ever need to realize that there is oftentimes an expiration date for interest or high-level popular interest when it comes to a hobby.
Sure.
Especially a collecting hobby. You're going to have people who are always going to be still interested, who are people who are interested in these things. There are people who are always going to be interested in Elvis. And there are going to be people
who... They still sell the records.
Yeah.
You know, they print a new vinyl. I'm sure it sells.
There are people who are always going to be interested in vintage video games. It's just going to be a hobby. But you have to have some sort of mainstream appeal for this to hold monetary value. And
it's all about...
It's not going to always hold the monetary value.
It's all about populations.
Yeah.
So what I've seen, at least, in the quote-unquote... a hobby, is that I saw it reach a point where I saw more collectors than I ever had before, probably, you want to say, 2014, where all of a sudden, it's the busiest I've ever seen it. Okay? prices shoot up to an astronomical level versus what they were before. I'd say 2014 is what I saw. Have game prices increased since 2014? Absolutely, they have. Not to the same degree that they had before that.
Right.
They haven't gone up to that same sort of exponential point. They've stopped. They've either leveled off. Some games have gone down in prices since then. We always talk about Earthbound being a nice watermark where that was $250 at one point. Now it's like $175. You know, that's a decrease from a high level. And yes, you always, like Ian said, you're always going to have people interested in retro video games. But we all are going to get older. And the question is going to be, is that when me and Ian either get out of the hobby and our games go back into the wild, like I said, I've no collectors that are getting rid of their entire collection. And it's not just a couple. And this isn't Pat trying to control the market. I'm just reporting what I see happen. When that happens, will you have the same amount of people then get into it to replenish that pool, the population pool of buyers and collectors?
Right.
And I don't see it happening for a couple of reasons. Because the people that are going to collect it hardest and the most are going to be the people like these Elvis collectors that are dying off that were around when it was originally popular, when they originally were listening to Elvis when they were teenagers, and now they want that collector's cup or that freaking plate, or you know what I mean? They want that.
Yeah.
They have a connection. We have a connection to the NES. That 15-year-old that's now listening to Elvis, are they going to want to go back 30 years afterwards and collect the same stuff that the 80-year-old had? Because they were originally around when Elvis was alive. Well, that 15-year-old that's playing Super Mario Brothers on the emulator now, or playing it on their to them an old Game Boy Advance. You know, oh my God, it's so old and retro. Are they going to want to buy games from the 80s
right.
that only are going to work on the, maybe not the original hardware? You got to figure out how to use it with a CRT. Or are they going to say, you know what, I like the games, I'll play some of the games, but I don't need to have the physical version of those games.
Sure.
And that's sort of where we, I think, are at. Where in pop culture, retro gaming is as big as it's ever going to be, or as big as I've seen it. When you see commercials for McDonald's or freaking Kellogg's Corn Flakes, and you see Mario on, I'm like, okay, that's it. That's the evidence I need that if major marketing and advertisers realize there's a market there mm-hmm. to advertise other products not related to video games, retro video games. But were those people that we see at a huge convention like Portland, are they going to want to buy the old games? Or do they simply like the culture of retro video games?
Right.
And want to be, and they want to have maybe a cool t-shirt, or they want to have a keychain. You know what I mean? Or they want to have some pixel art.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean that same person is to go out and spend thousands of dollars on a fucking little Samson.
And that's not a bad thing. It's just those are the ones that burn off first, and you lose that. I mean, that's interest out of the pool.
Sure. And there's other analogs. We've seen it with even in a smaller way with, like Ian said, with Atari games and Atari collectors. Atari games were super hot.
I always use that in other examples just within video games. To use an example within this culture specifically, Atari collecting. The value of a lot of the more expensive ones in the 90s is now half that.
Because for the same reasons, people getting older, you have less collectors to fill the gaps of the ones that are either getting out or could be dying. Atari collectors, the average age of Atari collectors has to be late 40s, early 50s by now, because we're talking 10, 15 years before a lot of people were playing the NES, right? They have their games. So any new games that
they've
pop out,
them, right?
they got them. They've had them forever. Mm-hmm. So how many new Atari collectors are you going to see get into the game in this day and age?
And I always think it's cute because I always talk about how we do get a lot of teenagers who are into it, but you're not going to replace all those collectors.
Absolutely not. And they're not going to be, again, one that's going to go for, I want to get every Atari game, which is impossible. I want to get 600 Atari games. No, they want like 10 or 20 or 30, mm-hmm. and they're going to be happy. And that could be the same with the NES. People are always going to want those 10 or maybe 20 or 30 games even, but who the fuck... It, you know, 7 years from now is going to really care about Goal 2.
Yeah.
Who the hell is really going to care about getting the NES version of Overlord? Even if it's uncommon or hard to find.
Trying to find a great example.
You got a big wall. Conan!
Ferrari Grand Prix Challenge.
A game Conan. That you reviewed. Conan, you reviewed that.
God, that game.
In a certain NES guidebook.
Fuck that game.
But that's a point, though. Does that make sense to anyone? That it's going to be the same way as probably as comics.
Yeah, Pat, that makes great sense. Woo,
I can hear him.
Pat!
Is that what the fan base is here? Yeah. The subscribers are? Common games people want to play, and maybe those few quote-unquote holy grails will be oddities that might be out there. But then for 80% of the games, who the hell cares? I mean, who the hell cares if you know, if people are really going to want to play Destiny of an Emperor 70 years from now on the NES? I don't know. A couple people will. Are people going to want to own it? No. So that's how we made the segue from Elvis collectibles to retro video games, I guess. So what I'm saying is, don't go out and
don't
sell
go
your
chasing
collection.
Waterfalls.
Don't go chasing waterfalls.
Please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you used to.
I think it comes back to... damn it. Love TLC.
Mm-hmm, me too.
Buy these games. Love these games because you actually love them for what they are. They're fun. Historical value. But if investing, no. Invest in a business, land, or fucking stocks. That's why I always come back to. Because there's always going to be winners or losers when it comes to collectibles like that. Look up those Star Trek collector's plates from the 90s and see how much they're worth nowadays. Probably not that much. Of course, some of them will find one that's worth like $10 million.
All right. I think okay. Hanging in for the next two.
Ian, do we have a scumbag?
Yeah, we do. We have a scumbag seller of the week.
Of my birthday.
Of your birthday.
Because we're recording this on my birthday.
The scumbag seller of birthday boys day. Day. Day.
And Ian, who's the scumbag?
This scumbag seller is the Card Guru 33.
Now, by the time you might be listening to this, this auction might have ended, but it's still worth talking about, plus from the other things the person's selling. But Ian, what are they trying to sell here?
An NWC Gold 1990 Nintendo World Championships NES game cartridge reproduction. With the humble starting bid of $199.99 or the fucking steal of a deal price buy it now of $499.99.
Okay.
$500 would have been too rich for my blood, but $499.99 the deal.
Here's the description. Please, in all caps, so just picture me yelling it. Please note this item is shipped directly to you from China. This is a reproduction of the famous 1990 World Championships game cartridge that plays exactly like the original. Let's see how you stack up against the world's best on real hardware.
You need an apostrophe there.
The card is complete with dip switches, which can be set up for the official contest time of 6:21. So in the past, there's been reproductions of the game. The most famous one on RetroUSB.com, which is a fine reproduction. Mm-hmm. I like it. It has dip switches, and you cannot mistake it for the original.
And it has a cute little, translucent shell.
Like blue or red version they have?
Like the blue one.
Good old bunny boy, RetroUSB. I have a couple problems with this. I don't know what this cartridge looks like, but the image that you have is of a real gold one, right? Not just that. Eagle-eyed eBay viewers will be able to tell that the image used with the gold in the background was pulled from a certain AVGN NWC episode that a certain NES punk was a part of. So, doubtful it looks like that, but we don't know what it looks like. But if it looks like that, that's a real cart pictured there. That's not a repro. Then the second picture is just screenshots thrown together. So, it's just a really weird listing, because even if you wanted the repro to look like the original, this is like a paradoxical scumbag. So
yeah,
because say you wanted to buy this to trick yourself or friends that this is a real gold one, I can almost guarantee you that what you buy is not going to be what's pictured, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it does, it's going to look really shoddy. So why not just show the knockoff for what it is? So are they really trying to trick people? I don't know. But it's weird that they're using a real picture and doing a $4.99 buy it now to maybe trick someone to think that might be real. It's just fucking bizarre, the listing. But then you go into...
You can buy Hagane complete for US $24.99.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
$44.99 for Hagane complete Super Nintendo version.
Oh, $59.99 or the starting bid of
$24.99. Oh, I saw just a $45 buy it now if you want to cut through that auction bullshit right there. You can buy PAL version N64 game cartridge you pick for only $49.99. You pick.
You pick.
Hey, you want that Wayne Gretzky hockey 99 for only $50? You can get it. The PAL version, though.
It's like happy hour. $3 U columns.
And then they picture some of the ones that I'm guessing you can find for cheaper than $50, like Turok 2, Seeds of Evil, and Star Wars Episode 1 Racer, and Battle of Naboo, and Xena Warrior Princess. So I'm not sure who this, you know. Oh, no, that. Okay, then you actually look at the drop down list. Okay, Sculptor's Cut, Castlevania Legacy of Darkness, Worms Armageddon, and Snowboard Kids 2. Okay. So they do want to try to pull you in, maybe. Then you can pick just those four games. Woo! How about the Super Nintendo Battletoads Double Dragon, $45 complete for Super Nintendo?
That seems like. That one stuck out to me as like.
Not worth your time versus trying to get the original? Complete?
Yeah, I don't know.
Dracula X complete for Super Nintendo for $45. Or you can just go for some other Pokemon games that look like they were done in my basement for Game Boy Color and Game Boy. So, there you have it. Not much else to say about this one, Ian, unless you want to expound upon it further.
No, it's fine.
But isn't that bizarre, though? Just the pictures used to for the NWC Gold? I almost want to buy this to see a real picture of this. Let's see how well done or not this is, you know. So, the card guru 33, you are the scumbag seller of Pat's birthday.
Yeah.
Birthday. Ian, this was announced right before we went to air. And it's interesting.
There have been rumors about it for a few days. This is, I believe, the first solid. At least it's solid because it's on Amazon. So Hyperkin is releasing a redone version of their original Retron. Yobo had one. All the clones started with simple plug and play. You drop an NES cartridge in the top boxes, and they went on from there to the dual playing units, to the triple units.
When did they originally come out? Like 2004 around?
I was going to say 2005 or 6.
You had the generation next before that. That dropped off. That was the first clone.
And disappeared completely. And then all of a sudden
the Yobo and the Retron.
Yeah, you had the FC console, you had the Retron, etc. And we're with all the popularity of the HD NES, you know, playing consoles now, the AVS.
Retro AVS.
The Analog NT.
Retron 5.
Yeah, the Retron 5. Retron is releasing for $39.99 an HD NES. You know, going back full circle, basically, and starting at the beginning. It's a really attractive price point. And apparently, it's going to be done with hardware, not emulation.
Emulate.
It'll upscale to 720p. It'll be switchable between 16.9 and 4.3. Thank fucking goodness. It'll do PAL and NTSC.
Via bottom case switch, which is interesting.
Yeah, so I guess there'll be a switch on the bottom for it.
Which leads you to believe that it's not software emulation, then.
Yeah, they say right down here, questions and answers, does this device use software emulation or is it a really good, or is it a hardware clone? And the manufacturer responds, the Retron 1 is all hardware, no emulation.
Also AV port, which I think is cool.
Yeah, so it can do AV, it can do HDMI. It's interesting because for $40, I mean, depending on how it looks, this is a really good cheap entry model. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles of things like the AVS or the Analog NT Mini, but it's affordable, and your NES games should, in theory, if this is decent, or at least does as well as the Retron 5 does, should make your NES games look nice for a reasonable price.
$40, and then if you get on Amazon, it's free shipping for Prime members. Yeah, this, you want to pay $40 or $160 for a Retron 5, or, you know, a lot for an AVS and even more for an Analog NT. This could be that solution going forward that you're going to see at the swap meet 5 years from now, people getting rid of their, you know, FC Twins and getting rid of their original Retrons. You know, this is going to be the new sort of cheap way to do it. Again, how is it looking? Is it simple, they put a cheap upscaler in there? or is there something else going on? That's a low price for that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same price as the regular, you know, knockoffs for the most part, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean,
they're definitely looking to make this their replacement, and I guess that's my only concern.
Cool.
For $39.99, what kind of upscaling are you getting?
It looks cool. They use the same colors of an NES. They use the same power and reset sort of button motif. The controller has a cool little angle on it. The console has a little triangle angle for some trapezoidal for some reason. And yeah, I'm just curious that the fact that it has an AV cable as well, that they just threw an upscaler in there, and who knows if there's going to be input lag or something of that nature with that versus like an FPGA that's in there.
It'll also be interesting to see, quite frankly, if it will handle EverDrives. I mean, is this someone's one and done on the road solution?
Well, it's hardware based, in theory.
Right? You know, the Retron 5 doesn't, but the Retron 5 isn't hardware; it's software emulation. You know, so if this is all hardware, you know, there's a possibility that this could be in a lot of con bags.
Not to give what you bring to a convention to play it.
Yeah,
give them a lot of con bags. Hey, come on in. Here's your Retron HD.
A lot of travel bags.
Looks like it comes with one controller.
Yeah,
one controller.
10-foot cable though.
10-foot cable. 3-foot HD cable. According to 6-foot micro USB cable, according to Amazon. Where did you see the question and answers? I don't see that link on here.
Scroll down.
Scroll down where?
Scroll down to customer questions and answers.
Oh, baby! Does not come with games. How many games are included in this version? Is Mario Brothers Contra Punch-Out included? That is so cute! They think it's like just a game with everything built in.
Yeah.
Or an NES Classic Edition. That is so funny. Maybe that's a new expectation now, where these systems come out like that one that came out from Hyperkin with all the Jalico and Taito games that came out.
I don't remember.
I think you were sick. You weren't around to talk about it.
Yeah, but we did talk about it. Whatever. Anyways,
that's the point though. Is that there's so many of these systems now.
Yeah.
With all these games thrown on, it's so cute that some people think, oh, where's Contra?
Even before the NES, many people would come in and look at them and just assume that they were loaded with games.
Nope. Got to go to your local mall and go to that cart stand selling all those, you know, Famicom fucking multi-carts that...
Hyper Italian Boys 2000.
They got their
plug and play.
They got their asses sued off by Nintendo, I think, so at some point in the early 2000s, the company that distributed all those. But anyway, I guess we'll have to wait and see what the reviews look like. Again, if it comes out where little input lag and the upscale looks good, you have a viable solution.
I'll slap my dick on it.
Okay, maybe. Is that how you're going to sell them in the store?
Yeah.
Dip it in ink and Ian approve, slap. Get a mushroom stamp on it. Oh. Hey, you opened that mushroom door.
Yeah. And so I'd like to end this CU podcast by saying happy birthday to Patrick. Happy birthday, Patrick.
Why was that delayed? Thank you. I
was just catching something. Here.
You're catching some of your gut. Are you doing the ball stretches still?
I am doing the ball stretches. Yeah.
Scrotum stretches. Stretches on a ball.
I am.
Have they helped at all?
No, they hurt like a fucking ass.
Well, no pain, no gain.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing it. It's just not doing the thing yet.
Every day?
Every day.
Are you keeping your stomach in that nice homeostasis where... you're not supposed to eat too much or too little. You're supposed to keep it always...
I'm doing my best.
Okay.
I overdid it a little bit with some barbecue, but you know, everyone has a day. Anyways, Vonnie and I have a great idea for your birthday, but we have to figure out what day we're doing it. But we're gonna make you leave.
Am I gonna be there?
Yeah, we're gonna have to make you leave the house.
Well, this weekend, I guess, you know.
Maybe this weekend.
Maybe a Sunday.
Yeah, I think it's gonna have to be a Sunday.
You know, Ian, I'm gonna have to drive you home.
Do you have all your shots?
What are you kidding? What, should we bear wrestling? Where am I going to go?
I just wanted to see your reaction.
Last time I had to get a bunch of shots, so I went to India in 2006 and had to take those freaking malaria pills for like a month and a half to make sure I didn't get anything.
Oof.
That was fun.
No, you don't need any shots for where we want to take.
That's a whole other story, my India trip. That was fun. Oh, my God. Anyway. All right, Ian, I'm going to take you home. I might come back for a couple of topics. It's not fun doing a podcast with you. I did the podcast with you for like 5 months. It was not fun. It was like homework.
We had fun. Our 2DS segment was a barrel of monkeys.
You sure you can't get through one more?
Yeah, I'm positive.
If I paid you?
No.
Well, I mean, you are getting paid, what I mean. Yeah. Pay you extra?
No.
You want to talk about the Video Game Hall of Fame inductees?
We talked about them already.
Oh, when they were first announced, but not the inductees.
Yeah, that's all that's important.
All right, get out of here.
All right.
All right. All right, a little bit of both YouTube and gaming news. And this has been developing after the announcement of Call of Duty World War II by Activision. They're going back to the past, where Call of Duty began. After Battlefield 1 came out, people are like, oh, I want to kill people with ancient technology. And so, after, I guess, the disappointing Infinity Warfare space war game, Call of Duty, they're going back to a World War II one for the 2017 Call of Duty game, which is fine. They, you know, people want to talk about these games. You have a big Call of Duty community. It's one of the biggest game franchises out there. The problem is with the changing in advertising recently, and with brands pulling out, Google / YouTube / Alphabet, you know, how many names you want to give it, wanted to give the people that are advertising more confidence and give them more control about where their ads were appearing on YouTube. So they gave them these greater controls. But they don't want, I guess, one of the ticks they could do or sliders, they don't want their ads to appear in front of anything that has to do with war or, you know, I guess, ultra-violence. So what's been happening is that the regular Call of Duty YouTubers, the ones that, some of these have millions of subscribers, covering Call of Duty news, gameplay footage, etc., their videos haven't been monetized the past several weeks because they're covering Call of Duty World War II, which is obviously bad. And it's not something that I would think even Activision would agree with, because to them, it's free advertising, obviously. It's getting the word about the game. It's helping build hype. It's a marketing platform that they don't have to worry about. The infrastructure is built in. You have YouTubers with millions of subscribers that are talking about Call of Duty for years. That's their bread and butter. That's what they've been getting paid for with YouTube ads for years. You know, the publisher loves that idea. Nintendo doesn't. They don't like the idea. But most game publishers see it's a win-win. For them, it's free exposure, it's less marketing dollars they have to worry about. Why not do that? But it's not working out with some of the in the Call of Duty YouTube community. Remember T. Martin, TMRTN, remember the CSGO skin gambling fiasco of last year? He made a tweet on April 30th that saying his channel made $113 on a 250,000 views of videos uploaded the past week. Then he said YouTube with a laughing cold sweat face. For those asking, he said that's really low. That's like a 15-cent CPM. Usually it's 10 to 20 times that, which is roughly accurate. $113 for close to a million views. Yes, that's not what usual monetization is on YouTube for those out there who aren't familiar with how it works. So something's definitely going on. And it's as simple as the advertisers, major advertisers, going into their now controls and seeing, like, you know, there's different categories now that they can choose. You know, profane language, violent content, and unclicking those for, why don't I want my ads to appear in front of these sort of videos? That's the controls that advertisers have that didn't have before. And this is affecting these YouTubers. It's affecting H3. H3 has done videos about it. Good old PewDiePie has many videos about it. This is affecting a lot of YouTubers, whether it's vulgar language, quote-unquote controversial, violence, war, things of that nature, where there are now people that are hired to go look for these videos, I guess to get a lot of views, and to flag them as maybe being one of these categories, so that if advertisers choose so, you know, if they click off that, I don't want my ads appearing in front of that category of video, ads will not appear for that particular brand. So what happens is then there's less advertisers overall because they'll be less likely to click on that dial on their controls. I think Activision, what's going to happen is I think situations like this are going to sort themselves out. Because obviously, if you're a big YouTuber before and you want to talk about a video game that had some violence in it, like Call of Duty, World War II, and now you're less likely to do so because there are less ads appearing there, you're going to just not produce it or work around it, whether it's titling the video differently or description, or maybe you're forced not to even use like the imagery of the World War II gameplay. And so that's going to get back to a company like Activision. Absolutely. They're going to look at this and be like, what the hell is going on? We now have less free exposure. Because before, it's not Activision paying for it. In essence, it's Google paying for it with their platform, their YouTube platform. But the advertisers are basically paying for the advertising for a company like Activision. So these game companies, if this keeps going in this direction, they're going to go to YouTube and complain, absolutely. Because they're going to see the amount of eyeballs overall promoting their games plummet, especially from these bigger YouTubers. Yeah, there'll be people that will fill in the blanks, but if you've talked about these franchises for 7-8 years, you build up a million or more subscribers, that's hard to replace when you're like a key influencer to that degree, to that group, to that genre of games, to that franchise itself. So developers are going to be mad because then they're going to have to then go directly to the influencers and then pay them maybe for coverage, which is not as organic. It has to be disclosed. There's FTC rules. You have to say whether or not you're being sponsored or, there's an ad placed in front of that. So this is going to be trouble. But do I think it's going to smooth itself out? I think it will over time. When you go from a place of no control at all for advertisers, which is inexcusable. Advertisers should have control about where their ads appear. They're the ones fucking paying for it. That's not an anti-YouTuber perspective. That's a common sense perspective. If I'm paying tens of thousands of dollars, I should have some control over where my ads go, or else you're not seeing my money. So you go from a situation where there was none of that to then them complaining and now getting control where it might be too broad now, where the categories are too broad, where if I click off, I don't want any video with any violent or war imagery, where now maybe I'm not realizing that includes video games that might have violence in it. Maybe I want that included. So I think this will be fine-tuned. I think this will soften out in the long run, where this will get more sophisticated. There'll be some give and take. Of course, right now, YouTubers are hurting. Some are hurting, and that's unfortunate. But it's the rubber band effect, where you go, nothing, snap. And then, it goes too far the other way. It's going to come back to the medium at some point. I'm just not sure how long that will take or should take. It could be months. It could be a year, 2 years before it gets to a more normal place, or it more closely resembles maybe TV, radio advertising, or internet advertising in general, where you could specifically maybe not block off videos that fall into a range of different types of content, but you proactively choose the channels you want your ads to appear in front of. So then you therefore know that, okay, this is a channel that has a few million subscribers. Maybe I don't care if they do something that's quote-unquote profane or uses vulgar language. I know that this is a proper partner for what the product I have that I'm trying to sell. I think we'll get there. It's just going to take a while, unfortunately. And for a situation, for someone like this prestigious Key, he has over a million subscribers. He has all his videos demonetized, trying to talk about Call of Duty World War II. It's unfortunate right now. It definitely is. There's going to be growing pains involved in this time period. I'm just hoping it gets sorted out. And I hope that they resolve a situation like this more sooner than later. But if this keeps happening with big game franchises, say the next GTA comes out, GTA 6 comes out, and then all of a sudden every video gets demonetized from GTA 6 talking about or showing it, you don't think Rockstar is going to be pissed about that because they want that coverage, they want it to continue strongly? Oh, they're going to be pissed. They're going to figure this out. I think it's just going to take a while, but they're going to figure it out. Guardians of the Galaxy. Those lovable intergalactic scamps. Volume 2 just came out over the weekend. Did gangbusters at the box office. Why wouldn't it? Probably the most anticipated film of this year, or probably top 3. The first one in 2014 came out with low expectations. everyone's saying, this is going to be the first Marvel failure. You know what? It was quite the opposite of that. It did better than what anyone could have expected. It sort of broke the mold of the Marvel Universe movie to that point. It was a space adventure. You know, it was basically the tone of what a Fantastic Four movie could be if in the right hands. Both in comedy, in terms of, space aliens, saving the universe, saving the galaxy. A Fantastic Four movie could fit into that mold, absolutely. So 3 years later, you have the sequel. And then you have James Gunn back, both writing and directing it. And I'm glad that, well, he was given some leeway on the first one. To at least develop the story, and then Marvel obviously loved the idea, and then after that success, you know, probably mostly hands off for the sequel, because he earned that credit from the first one, because the movie made a ton of money. People love this franchise, they love the characters. Now, that before Guardians of the Galaxy, this was a C-list franchise. This was, you know, talk about Cloak and Dagger series coming out. Cloak and Dagger was a lot, and that's far down the Marvel sort of totem pole. Cloak and Dagger was a hell of a lot better known than Guardians of the Galaxy, even before before these movies came out. You know, you have the lovable rogue, but then you have a huge tree. You have a little raccoon named Rocket shooting people, saying I'm gonna murder you. Drax the Destroyer, and you have Gamora. You have this ragtag group that most people before the first movie came out were like, okay, this is too insane to work on film. People will be turned off. But no, the personalities of the characters, the interplay between them, the fact that it was not what people were expecting at all, if they knew what to expect. I mean, you know, they saw the trailers using 70s and early 80s music. Like, okay, this is something weird and different. And that's what got butts into the theater. But for the sequel, I think the expectations were so high that it'd be tough to match it going into the first one, not knowing what you're going to be getting. Besides, you know, you had those wacky trailers for the first one. So it's made a ton of money. I think it made a little more than the first so far. On Rotten Tomatoes, you got 82%, not as high as the first one, but still certified fresh. The critics' consensus: Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2's action-packed plot, dazzling visuals, and irreverent humor adds up to a sequel that's almost as fun, if not quite as thrillingly fresh, as its predecessor. Which, to me, is fair. Of course this isn't going to be as fresh. In the first one, you're discovering this, snarky space thief. You have a green super alien assassin. You have a freaking little raccoon killer with a New York accent, you have a killer tree, and you have a muscle-bound, dry, humor-esque character played greatly by Dave Bautista. So you're not going to be able to recreate that magic of getting them together and world-building for the sequel. But what you can do with the sequel, and what was done here, was develop all those characters and build upon what you learned about them in the first one, and that's what you did here. So there's going to be some spoilers here. I'm going to have to get into it, but what I was most shocked about when I saw Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and I did enjoy the film, was how much it was driven on character versus plot. The plot is so thin and simple that it's almost meaningless. It's almost just there in order to grow these characters, which is what James Gunn wanted to do. James Gunn obviously loves these characters. Every character, from the normal characters to ones that came back from the original, Yondu, Nebula. You know, we're talking sort of the villains of the first film are given so much more to do and are so much more integral to the plot and are given all development. Yondu, played by Michael Rooker, was probably the highlight to me in the sequel. Not that he was a throwaway character in the first one, but he's so fleshed out in the sequel and given a very, very dramatic and sensical character arc that it's almost an entirely different movie in terms of tone than the first one. Yes, you know, you still have the irreverence. Drax is played almost solely for laughs in the sequel, in the and he almost has nothing to do in the sequel, but it doesn't matter in terms of the action of the characters versus their interactions with each other and sort of the emotional bonds they develop and how much you learn about them. And again, everyone's given a chance to do that. The only character I would argue that does not have a real character arc, Drax, really doesn't. That much. He's almost just there as the pure comic relief, which is funny because in the original, that was more Rocket was the pure comic relief and in Peter. But then Rocket's given a very, very small character arc that he was almost given just to... You got to have him go through some sort of a, you know, semi-emotional scene. It really wasn't needed, but it kind of works. They wanted everyone to have some development, so I could see that. But Nebula had a nice little arc and development with her sister Gamora. And then, of course, you have Peter learning about himself, learning about what real family is, as he, spoilers, meets his dad, played by Kurt Russell, who's Ego the Living Planet. And again, the plot, to me, is the weakest part of this film. And in terms of the action, you have the set piece in the beginning played almost for comedy, and it's very original and unique in the fact that your eyes aren't even on the main action. You're on little baby Groot dancing around with the action basically happening in the background, which is sort of playing off of Groot's development from the end of the first film where he starts dancing around to the Jackson 5 song. Oh, which is fine. It's cute. Yes. Is it played for marketing? Is it played for less? Sure. Is it overdone? No. Yeah. It really depends on your perspective. Is that too Disney-fied for you? If you want to take that argument, fine. But I didn't mind Baby Groot at all. It was cute to me. And it played into the plot in certain points, the innocence of the character. So I didn't mind that. It wasn't there just as an add-on, you know, like, oh, we'll just laugh at Baby Groot and now, you know, he doesn't really belong with the rest of the story. No, there's a reason for certain actions here and there with Baby Groot. And now, who's now, spoiler, is going to be Teenager Groot, I guess, in the third film, which to me is an interesting sort of change. But I did see someone complain, oh, this is a Disney-fied Marvel movie. And today, that I would ask, I would think you were absolutely out of your fucking mind if you thought that. Are there cute moments? Yes. Are there comedic moments? Yes, as there were in the first film. There is a moment in this film which is probably the most violent I have seen in any Marvel Studios movie to this point. Spoilers, click off if you want to hear it. There is a scene of mass homicide played to a, you know, a 70s song, which I can't, off the top of my head, remember which one it is, by Yondu basically murdering all the Ravagers that turned on him. And yeah, you can say, well, it was self-defense. Okay, it was, but boy, that's a sort of a shocking scene. That's trying to be played for a little bit of comedy where his magic arrow is killing literally dozens and dozens, maybe 100 different people. And then Rocket shooting some as well. Just people with no chance of survival just getting slaughtered en masse. If you can find that in any other Disney movie, let me know. Because that to me, that's not Disney at that point. That's James Gunn doing his thing. And it's a very effective scene, by the way. And it's a beautifully shot. You have the bodies falling in slow motion inside the ship. And while I'm at sort of all the character arcs, even Yondu's, his shipmate, who was in the first film, the guy with the little beard goatee, even he has a bit of a character arc. Even Taserface, the funny, Ravager who mutinies, against Yondu, he has a character arc. Like, everyone's giving some sort of development, which, again, it was almost too much, but you appreciate that everyone goes from a point A to a point B in a movie like this. And again, there isn't a huge amount of action. You have the action in the beginning for 5 minutes, you have the big set piece at the end, and you have a couple of little minor action scenes in the beginning. The murderous rampage of Yondu, not entirely action because it's really one-sided. And then you have Rocket fending off in a funny way, comedic way. He's fending off the Ravagers coming after him for the bounty. That's really it for the film. Kind of shocking, but I don't think audiences are going to care that much because they love these characters already. What I'm sort of scared of is the tone of these movies And you can say, yes, all the Marvel movies have comedy in them, even Captain America, even Civil War. But that's always sort of under the surface where, like, for a movie like Civil War, you needed the comedic elements in order to take the pressure off the drama that was going on, the heaviness of the plot. When you throw, like, the Avengers in with Guardians of the Galaxy for these Infinity War movies, they got to be really careful. The Russo brothers, and I'm sure they could pull it off, but they got to be careful not to mix the tones too much between the comedy first and the drama first with comedy underneath, you know, elements. Because, yeah, there's a lot of drama and emotional scenes in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but first and foremost, this is a space comedy still. That's also action. It's space comedy with action in it. But, you know, I really like this movie. I thought it took risks, being that it wasn't action heavy. Is it a perfect movie? Absolutely not. You can see the quote-unquote plot twist of the villain happening a mile and a half away. Is there a way around that? Yeah, they could have done that. They could have written that moment leading up to that to be more of a shock. They could have hidden it a little bit more, but it is what it is. No movie's going to be perfect out there. But for what it is, Guardians of the Galaxy gets my recommendation. I think it's worth your time to see that. It's not a Disney movie. When I saw that comment from someone that it was a Disney movie, well, yeah, technically they financed it, but it's not a Disney tone movie. This isn't for kids, even though there's gonna be a lot of families that go and see this. So interesting to see where they lead to the third film from there. And it is worth sticking around for the 75,000 post credit scenes. There's actually five. One has something to do with the plot. One could lead into a spinoff. And then the rest are just for fun. For funsies. So I enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Looking forward to 3. And not looking forward to the Spider-Man movie because the trailer stinks. And the rest of the audience I was with seeing the trailer weren't excited. But Thor Ragnarok, everyone is up. They're excited for that one. So I'm kind of ashamed now that I want to see Thor Ragnarok more than Spider-Man Homecoming, since Spidey's my favorite superhero. I'm going to blame Sony for that, since they still have some control over that. But anyway. That's it for this CU podcast for my birthday, May 9th. If you like the podcast, and if you haven't done so, please subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, or your platform of choice. You can like the podcast. That helps give it a boost. And subscribe and leave a comment for the podcast on your platform of choice as well. If you want to advertise with the CU Podcast, it's CUPodcast@thepunkeffect.com. Reach tens of thousands of listeners. Oh, yes, tens of thousands. If you want to directly support Ian and I with the CU Podcast, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/CU Podcast. I will be at Retro Spillmessen May 20th and 21st in Norway. Maybe I'll see you guys there. If you're in the Scandinavian area, I'll be returning to Too Many Games at the end of June in Pennsylvania. I have my app, Ultimate Game Guide for NES, and of course the book's always available at ultimatenes.com. So for my partner, Ian Ferguson, I am Pat Contry. We will see you next time with episode 99 as we build to 200. 200? I mean 100. What? Yeah, 100, 200. No, I'm going to retire before that, maybe. But 100. We're building towards 100, and we'll see you next time.